Horses with Steve Bick. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
A national network. A very good morning from Ocala. Rolling right in. That was unexpected. I didn't know the mic was open, Casey. Good morning. Sirius 219 XM 201 Sports Zone 964. If you're listening to Sirius XM on live, I was just explaining to Gary Fenton how, you know, with 9 o'clock, they throw the switch. They open the floodgates at the network. We're what's called the pass-through. And so they throw a switch like at a train yard, and we the train comes through for 3 hours. Then they throw the switch off. They won't let me go. I think one time actually they let us. Somebody forgot to turn us off, like the stop betting button. So, do you want a headset?
Sure.
Take the headset. We'll get. I was gonna. Exactly. They were gonna pull this baby out of the station. Good morning, everybody. Live from OBS, day two of the Ocala Breeder Sales Company, two-year-old in training sale, the first sale of the year, and a sale that has gained more and more traction. That was even before what has transpired in terms of no Gulfstream sale, no Florida sale, going back to, a few years. The Calder, it's loud. It's loud on you. Let's.
Your voice is fantastic.
Thank you. It's resonant this morning. I've had a goofy situation. I got a slow leaking tire on the rental. It's a whole type of complete situation. All right. So let me see. That's my headset. How about now? A little better. A little bit more. All right. There we go. I filled the tire yesterday. I thought, all right, let's see if it's a valve. You can't really see anything. So this morning, sure enough, the thing was down again to 12 pounds per square inch or whatever.
That doesn't seem like a lot.
To get you where you're going.
Well, it was enough because I'm very close. There they are. I'm good. We'll get you guys at some point?
Yes.
All right. I called Hertz actually this morning, and I said, is there somebody you work with here? Oh yeah, go to Tire Kingdom. So we'll give Tire Kingdom a plug. So you just go there, tell them it's a rental, and they'll if they just have to plug a nail.
Sure. Have you gone there yet?
No, I this morning. It's
so
fine,
should
it's
you be plugging them before you go?
Oh, it's a tire. It's a tire shop. What can they do?
You have a lot of confidence.
I do. They take the tire. They look at. Take it off. They look at it. You ever see them do that with the water?
Sure. The
and
whole
they
test.
Spin the. Yeah, and they watch for the bubbles to come out. Yeah, it's very. It doesn't take much.
I can't wait to hear about it tomorrow.
Nobody needs to. There's plenty of goofy things we talk about on this show. This is not one that needs, to come to full fruition and flower. You sent me a note. You said it's great to see you at Santa Anita and at NHC and now at the sale. But what about you?
You are the hardest working man in this industry, and I meant that sincerely when I sent that to you. I see you at Santa Anita. I see you at NHC. I see you everywhere, and I'm just wondering if your family misses you.
Until the paperwork gets filed, she seems happy with me, and she seems happy when I come home. The cats have actually now attached themselves to her because she's feeding them every morning. There's four of them. So the cats have had the cats don't recognize they, you know how a cat is. They you're not around. What do I need you for? So yeah, no. But she's still. I got her something nice. In New Orleans.
You're obviously doing something right.
A couple of things. as for you, you did something right. I could start with TOC. I could start with Little Red Feather. You bought two horses yesterday. Let's talk about the final table. Is that the biggest thrill in recent memory?
It was an incredible weekend. I mean, absolutely. It was gut-wrenching. It was nerve-wracking. And in the end, it was an incredible moment. And I've been only part of the NHC now for the last couple of years. I told my wife, speaking of family, I wanted to try this, and she looked at me and she said, "Do you think you're as good of a horse player as Frank and Teddy?" I'm talking about Frank Mermenstein and Ted Koppel, who are big horse players.
Absolutely.
And I said, "Absolutely not." but I wanted to get in there and mix it up and see what it's like. And I'm a owner and a breeder and a syndicator and now on the TLC board. And I wanted to better understand the horse player, because they feed our industry. They're as important as anybody in this industry. And it's been a wonderful experience for the last four times that I played in it. The NTRA puts on an unbelievable event. In talking to horse players, you can tell how much they appreciate the effort that goes into it. You can see over the years that it's just the legends that our horse players play in this event. It's a wonderful experience.
How do you qualify? How
do I qualify? Typical events. I play at Santa Anita on the weekend event, or I play at horseplayers.com. I actually have a good story about how I qualified for the first time. It was a live event, and I was in third place. The top two finishers went to the NHC. I was only a couple of dollars behind. There was one race left, and I was sitting there with Frank and Teddy and all my people at the racetrack, and I just needed a score. I was $2 behind or whatever it was, and I just needed a score with the top two not having the same horse. And it was the Woodbine race, and I liked the five, and I sat down, and Eddie Freeman comes over. Great trainer, great
sure.
guy. And also one of the only people in the world that get the Matisse numbers, the great Paul and Duke Matisse on the figures. And nobody ever gets to look at him. I saw him for a quick second just because they were teasing me about it. And just at that moment, Eddie sits down, and Frank and Teddy tell him, I'm trying to qualify for NHC. I'm in third place. And he looks at me, and he says, "Do you want to know who Duke likes?" And I said, "Of course I want to know who Duke likes." So I like the five, and he looks at me and he says, "Duke likes the two." And I like to think of myself as not having a big ego, but at that moment I thought to myself, well, Duke didn't get me to the third place with one race to go. I got here. And for whatever reason, I decided not to listen to Duke's selection. I went with my selection, and Duke's horse won by a pull. I mean, when the gates opened, Duke's horse looked like a winner from the very first jumps. And I learned a very important lesson at that moment that my wife was right. I am not as good as these great horse players.
Well, you were Friday, Saturday, and Sunday last week. You were because, as it happens, I mean, the only Team Matisse Group player that had a big NHC was John Nichols, and John had a great week. Got both of his tickets into the semifinals, but I was watching you, and you would kind of bubbled up to the surface, and you start late Friday, you start to watch, and then Saturday, as the day progresses, you see names that kind of come up, that sometimes they go down, and then you see some that are like a needle, kind of bobbing up and down, and I saw that you were in major contention, and then you entrenched yourself, and I happen to have the tally here. This is how we keep the final table decisions listed, they walk everybody through what your mindset was going into the semifinal Sunday, and knowing that you had, a legit shot, and it was, it was not a weekend for bomb throwers.
No.
It was absolutely a grinded out, accept prices, that were, I don't want to say logicals, that were possibles at the right price. Those 9-2 types, $12, $14 horses. I mean, when guys like Paul Sherman are taking 8-5s, tells you a lot.
Well, so Saturday, like you said, I started making a little bit of run in the afternoon, and I hit three straight mandatories. And as you know, when you win a mandatory, everybody else loses a race. And that brought me all the way into the top hundreds and then in the top 50s, and then I ended the day third. And at that moment, you're there for fun, and you're there having a good time and camaraderie with a lot of horse players. And, you go to bed Saturday night thinking, man, you know, you don't want to, you know, you're in third. You don't want to lose third at that point. So woke up Sunday and started looking at the card, and like you said, realizing that on the morning line there were even money shots and 4 to 5 shots, and it just seemed like the type of morning that was going to play to a lot of favorites. And being in third place and having a sizable lead over a lot of players, including just staying in the top 10 to get into the final table. So my strategy was to sort of just go easy and not bet a lot of races at first, knowing that favorites had to lose and these horse players had to take some long shots to get up and catch me. And I believe the top 10 that started Sunday morning, only two were replaced. So it was very, very tough to move up in the standings. So I was very fortunate to be where I was, and I played it that way in the morning. As it turns out, there were very few bombs that came in, and I maintained my position without really hitting a lot of races in the morning.
Well, and, you know, you started Sunday in third, as you mentioned, and then when everything, you know, the dust settled, you maintained third, and, you know, you what'd you have? You had two winners at the final table and one place horse.
Yeah, I did okay. And that first race really shook me a little bit because I stood next to, they put everybody in that center stage and everybody's watching you. Yeah. And you're watching the race and they put up the numbers. And I got to meet the winner for the very first time. He was a super, super guy. He said, I get your emails and I love Little Red Feather and hopefully one day I can own a horse. And I looked at him, I said, well, maybe if you win this, you know, you could probably
it's
afford
your chance.
And he said he was a big Oaklawn guy and he played Oaklawn all weekend. And I'm a Santa Anita guy. We canceled Friday. We were off the turf Saturday, and the final race, I believe, was the only race that I played at my home track. And
wow.
So when I see the Oaklawn guy, and the gates open, and they put up the 8 horse, and a lot of people had the 8 horse, including him on both of his tickets, right, I believe?
Yep.
And
yes.
I thought, right at that moment, I was going to lose. That 8 was going to be the winner, and I was on the wrong horse. But thankfully, I finished second. And again, maintained my position. I had a nice lead over fourth and fifth and sixth. But as the races were going in the final table, they were starting to catch me.
Well, you did not. There wasn't much movement really after that. And it was pretty clear going in that that Paul Kalia was probably uncatchable. And you know, the final table format, I mean, we make it work, and we try to add drama to it. But it has been generally, you know, kind of anticlimactic to some degree. I mean, everybody who played their best pretty much, you know, went home with nice checks. And that includes you, $200,000.
Yeah, that's a sizable amount of money. There's no doubt. I have a 9-year-old and a 7-year-old. So when people ask me, what am I going to do with the money? I'm going to say, my kids are going to be able to continue with their education, and deservedly so.
That should pay for at least a semester by the time they get to school.
Nowadays, yes.
Hey, kids. Cal State Northridge. There you go. You're
right,
in.
Right. You can go to Brent's Deli every morning.
Now you're talking. Well done. That's all I can say. You know, we had Doc Bustani, which is a wonderful story considering his you know, dire circumstance, health-wise.
Like a sweet person.
Oh, lovely guy. And the Louisiana faithful all rallied around him. They all know him from Lafayette. And that was fabulous. You know, Kalia with the two entries, the Stephen Wells story. And you mentioned two people that forged into the final table. George Novick. The career weekend for him as a horse player. He's an owner, and we had horses in our barn with Siaka, and now is down in at Parks with the Pharaohs with Mike and Patty, and he wins the Thursday preliminary, the last chance, first chance, and then then gets into the top. He had gotten to the top 10 with two races left, and in the semifinal session. Had fallen out, and then hits those last two to get back in to make the final table.
Amazing.
Tremendous for George.
Like UCLA did a couple years ago, from the first four to the final four.
Yeah, unbelievable. Unbelievable. Really, their stories are just so much fun. And we'll get a few more in. And I owe Paul, he was taking his time driving home.
That's right.
Kalia. So we'll catch up with him probably early next week and have a nice, you know, sort of give him a chance actually for the dust to settle. All right, so that's Gary Fenton's first order of business. Now let's move to sale conversation, because you were active yesterday, and Jessica Martini is going to join us at 10:30 to recap day one, which was frankly a lot like NHC. There were a couple of, you know, cap horses, and most of it was grinded out. You know, kind of a slow start, which always seems to happen. You know, the outs slow you down. You know, people settling in and you know, starting to, you know, get going. But ultimately, there she is again, Jane Lyon, unbelievable with Zinze, the Justify, that colt that fetched $1.2 million, Sienna and Windstar, the Maverick Racing, $1.2 million for this one. Hartley DeRenzo, who, you know, Jimmy Ventura said yesterday, you can expect you know, some big balloons. They also had the number two fetch, and I was in the ring for this. This was the Uncle Mo that, you know, I guess it's a set, you know, you guys pinhook. You'll talk about that. $575,000 as an RNA at Saratoga last year, $950,000. Had been a $360,000 weanling. Unbelievable. Bred by Aaron Sones and the Heilingbrotts and Jackpot. And the Heilingbrotts were active yesterday. Three big purchases. And that was notable. We hope to talk to John Sikora later, because Good Magic with a $725,000 Stone Street bred that Stephen Young signed. This was late in the session. This was one of the last hips through the ring. $725,000. The top filly was $750,000. The Koreans and a City of Light. Big score for City of Light. So those are some of the top lines. Talk about what you guys were looking toward. You're buying, you're selling, you're trading. Little Red Feather.
Well, first of all, it's great to be here. Tom Ventura, Wojo, they put on a great sale. March has become, it was the premiere, and then April became the premiere, and then March is still a premiere because it's the first sale, and there's a lot of quality horses here. And you can walk around the ground. While walking around the grounds, you see everybody. Everybody's here. All the big buyers are here. All the big sellers are here. And it's a great event. And we were fortunate enough to kick things off with two horses right off the bat. And as a buyer at the sale, you just never know how it goes. You spend your time and you're watching all of the breed shows, and then you're walking the grounds and you're touching the flesh. And then Mr. Vet comes in and he can just destroy all of your work, literally in one phone call.
Your hopes and dreams.
No. And then hundreds of hours have just been wasted. But this was so far a pretty fortunate sale for us. Mr. Vet was kind with the horses that we selected, and they were early. We were number three, and I remember Cott Campbell, who's the godfather of syndicates, would always be the first of the day, and he'd come in and he'd buy that horse for $100,000. So we felt a little bit like Cott with number three, and we got lucky. Once you get in there and you raise your hand, you can buy any horse you want, Steve. All you have to do is keep raising your hand, and you better have the wallet to pay for it. But Little Red Feather, we try to syndicate horses that are reasonable but still championship quality, and these two yesterday just fell right into our lap.
Well, you know, I would have thought that Aaron Wellman had bought that purchase concept that from Cott, that nobody else was allowed to go in and buy early, because he got everything else from Dogwood, so he should have that. He should have the ownership of that concept. No, that is a very funny scenario. Before people, you know, come into the ring and sit down and get settled on the day, or if they're in the back ring and or they're, you know, back in the barns and they're not paying attention, and they get, and all of a sudden, this was the first Mattoli to sell, went in 10 flat. The one that's fascinating, though, both fillies, by the way, the one that's really fascinating is the Twirling Candy, who went 9-4, and it feels like the $145,000 may very well be a bargain here. I mean, based on certainly on breeze times.
Well, let's be honest. Anytime you buy a horse, you feel like you got a bargain, but most of the time. And it always feels great when you buy the horse and then come to California and hopefully they turn into that fast horse that you purchased. We like that horse from the very first day that we saw her. She's wonderfully bred by Hunter Rankin and Walker Hancock by themselves, not with their families or anything like that. Sold pretty cheaply, though, inexpensive as a wingling. But as horses do, they grow in different spates. And this one grew up a little bit later, and we were fortunate enough to grab her yesterday.
What's interesting when you see a breeze time, you know, 10 flat, 9 and 4, the top figures, which attract attention. I mean, right away, that's part of the process. And you think, oh, well, maybe, and you see that price, and you think, well, maybe the physical wasn't great, or maybe the page wasn't great, but the page is great, and the physical looked fine. It feels like you were on a horse that maybe not as many people were on.
You do an analysis before the day starts of where you think these horses are going to go and whether you can afford it or not. And sometimes you will throw out a horse that you think will go for $500,000 and they end up in that one or two, and you start thinking to yourselves, what did we do wrong here? But the same thing happens the other way, where you're on a horse and you think, man, we may have to spend $300,000 for this horse. And all of a sudden at 130 and 140, you're looking around going, did we miss something?
Mm-hmm.
But we're confident enough, at least after the first 20 years that we've been in business, to know that when you like a horse, stay confident, buy the horse, and move on to the next one.
Wow. Two purchases for Little Red Feather, LRF, of course, and... How many more do you have? Do you have some hit lists today or tomorrow?
And I'd like to leave the sale up to five. We don't really try to put a number on it. We have over 300 active partners, and they've been calling us wondering when the next horse was. So we know our partners are there, ready to buy another horse with us. But it has to be the right horse. So a lot of times we come to the sale, and our partners are looking for horses, and we could buy up to five, and we leave with nothing because for whatever reason.
It's just the way it is.
You don't want to leave with any horse. You want to leave with the right horse.
That's well framed. You're also selling.
Yeah, about 7 years ago, in conjunction with Tom McCrocklin, we started a Pinhook division. Some of our investors like all facets of the game and learning and being educated in all aspects of the game. And this is our seventh two-year-old Pinhook venture that we've done. We have 39 horses that we're selling. Overall,
right.
We have six. We have six in the sale. We sold one yesterday. As much as we like to hit home runs, what turns a profit are just the singles and doubles that you hit along the way. And we hit a nice double yesterday.
Which one?
It was hip 211.
There we go. This was a mastery colt that Julie Davies prepared. Julie preparing all your babies?
We have five consigners. We have Tom McCrocklin, Julie Davies. We have the Demerics. We have Omar Ramirez. And Paul Sharp.
Very nice. All so a little bit well spread out. Willis Horton Racing.
Willis Horton Racing. This is a horse that's just been absolutely solid for us since the day we bought her. Mastery hasn't exactly done what we had hoped. When you buy certain stallions in September, you've got 6 months to either improve or not improve the page from a stallion standpoint. But the horse developed really, really nicely. And again, we knew that we had a really, really good horse. And she came on the stable ground, and she breezed well, and she looked good. And a lot of people were looking at her, and we got a couple of vets. And at the end of the day, we put a reasonable reserve on, and we had a couple of bidders.
Perfect. And actually, it was a nice page, too. The dam's got black type underneath her. And I guess it's true, mare. And... $250,000. What'd you buy? What'd you pay for?
I think we paid $100 for her.
So there you go. That's a perfect
a nice double.
Two and a half times. There you go.
Sale on a really, really good horse.
What today? How many today? Go through.
We got a couple in today and a couple in tomorrow. And right now I'm about to head over to the consigners and kind of see where we are. Again, really, really nice horses. I wouldn't say home run types, but certainly not horses that I wouldn't recommend to anybody that came up to me and said that they were looking for a quality horse.
Hips? You want to give some hips out?
I'd rather not, Steve. I'd rather just kind
you of... You can advertise them so people...
Nah, I don't like to do that.
All right. Everybody's superstitious in their own special way. Is there, among the first crop sires, anything that you're spotting that, when it comes to that aspect, how much input do you have, or do you leave it to some of the advisors?
Everybody's got a role on the team. My particular role is a little bit more pedigree and page and whatnot,
nice.
Not necessarily horse flesh. And so it's still a little early to really talk about the sires. It's a unique year for those first crop sires. Some of them are really looking well, and others that I still believe in that I think will rise up to the top. But you have to obviously see it at the sales and other buyers and bloodstock agents need to see what you're saying. So we'll see what happens.
The only thing you can do is compare them to what they looked like in September, more or less, and how the babies of the various stallions are being reported, when owners go, to the farms at this time of year and see, how they're looking. And then, you can actually read between the lines, too, reading typically consigners, developers, their opinions, when they're asked at this time of year as the two-year-old season starts, and they describe certain ones as being, as being forward, and this one, this one's a little slower maturing, and body and mind, and there's a curve with all of these. There's a great quote because of that Arrogate. One of the good sellers yesterday, the Spendthrift, Frank Fletcher, purchased $525, and this was a huge pinhook success for Raul Rojas, and he bought that Arrogate colt for $50,000 because somehow people were down on Arrogate. Because I guess they were surprised that his babies didn't win first out at 5 furlongs. Well, are you kidding? And then, of course, immediately after September, the Arrogates, started to stretch out, and they started to mature, and they started to win. And so here's a horse that he paid 50 for and sells for 5 1/4.
Well, one of the reasons why I don't want to mention any first-year sires is a year from now, somebody pull up, you didn't like Arrogate, whoever it was. But it is early. And the only thing that's establishing that market value right now is really just a couple of sales here and there. And you're not seeing him
it's
on
crazy.
The racetrack. And then when you're seeing him on the racetrack, like you said, you're not necessarily seeing the full development of them in terms of you need at least a year or two. And so, and what you see at the two-year-old sales, which is unbelievable, and the way this market works, you see a guy like Bob Baffert, and I don't know that he looks at the page. He looks at the athlete. He looks at the flesh. He looks at what the horse is, and he doesn't care what is on the page. And when you get to a two-year-old sale, the page is great. I'm not going to lie. The page helps. It can only help sell your horse. But really, at the two-year-old sales, it's the breeze time. It's the way they look. It's the gallop out time. It's the way they look on the shank when they're back at the barn.
The walking.
You have an athlete at that point.
Yep.
They, many times, they've outrun their pedigree.
Well, and in fact, Sid, I heard from Sid Fernando last night. Sid, back from New York in Tampa on his way here today. So Sid will sit in tomorrow. And Sid wrote that piece last year, and it's funny because Lauren Gash also talked about this about Hideki Mori not caring about what the page is, not looking at anything other than the physical. Sid wrote that piece about Baffert, the list of progeny that he's had that ended up being the best runner for whatever sire. Because just for that reason, that it didn't matter. I mean, that essentially, this one looks good. You know who's also has that philosophy is Seth Klarman. Seth Klarman has bought what is considered offbeat and obscure pedigrees, and has done well with that, and just strictly on physical. Now, of course, he's got a wherewithal to you know, to make mistakes. I mean, not everybody, you know, not everybody can buy a dozen or 15 or 18 every season, or like Viola and Rapoli, 60, and you know, and eat the ones that go bad or just aren't good enough. So anyway, it speaks to the variety of approaches.
The beauty of a game, right? Everybody's got, some people like pedigree only, some people like athletes only, and everything in between.
Well, the little red feather portion of the sale conversation with Gary Fenton, who starting the morning with us, just perfect. Kip Elser is going to join us in a couple of minutes. Best of luck the rest of the way on that front. Now we got to turn to a slightly thorny issue, and what has got to be, is it the biggest challenge of the racing side of your interests, the TOC, and having to essentially, you know, try to avoid the landmines and responding to pressures that no other market in the country is dealing with.
Well, it's interesting that you say that. I grew up with a family. My father was the mayor of Beverly Hills, and he's only one of two people, Will Rogers and himself, who've held all three elected positions in Beverly Hills. And it was instilled in me, give back to your community and donate your time. So when we got into this business and learning about the various stakeholders, it seemed only, you know, natural for me to want to help out, and so I joined the TOC. And you're right, I joined it at the time where things back in 2016 or 2017, where things were a little bit more, you know, normal, if you can even call it that. I don't even remember really a time when it was normal back in California. And then 2019 hit, and everything changed for us out there. Thankfully, in the last couple of years, in great part to the stakeholders that we have out there in terms of the Strana Group and the Del Mar Thoroughbred Club, and the great executives out there, Aiden Butler, Josh Rubenstein, Craig Frabel, we've been able to turn the tide a little bit. Right now we have 2,500 horses in California, which is now a growing trend, more than we've had in a long time. At Del Mar last summer, we had 2,900 horses, which we hadn't had in years and years and years.
The win and you're in, a big part of that success.
Big part of that, that Del Mar started a number of years ago. Record purses at Del Mar last year, record purses again this year, record purses at Santa Anita. And it really was a team effort back in 2019. Aiden Butler just put his butt at Clocker's Corner every single morning and willed everybody through what happened to us and the horses out there, and really brought everybody together and realized we can't do it alone. Everybody has to buy into this new concept with all the new safety measures. And we didn't know at the time how well they would do. We knew they'd be expensive, and we knew that we had to do something to change the tide. And these safety measures that came in were incredible. And everybody bought into them. And now here we are looking back going, what took us so long? It's much better to have 16 eyes on a horse every single day than two eyes. And it's really working. You're seeing it in the numbers and the fatality numbers and the reductions that we have. And the other states that came on board and adopted the same safety measures, and then HISA came in. And I think that where we were in terms of where we are today, and I'm saying this, and your listeners may say, oh, I didn't know any of this, or I wasn't aware of any of this. Well, I'm on the front line. So it usually, when things happen, then the rest of the country starts hearing about it 3, 6, 9 months later. Actually, things in California are pretty good, and I'm pretty happy about the way things are headed.
How are you fielding? You mentioned the eyes on horses, and what could certainly be argued. I mean, we had discussions with John Sheriffs and John Sadler, among others, Mark Glatt out there last week or 2 weeks ago, and the concerns and the frustrations of, frankly, a non-racetrack practicing veterinarian deciding that they know better than career horsemen, and you come over here. You must be getting frustrated calls from owners.
I do throughout the years. I have, and I wouldn't say recently. They're more than any other time. I can only give you my example, and we've had, I think, 4 or 5 vet scratches, or panel scratches, as they call it, over the last couple of years. And I got the same call from my trainer that I would get from an owner taking the call as a TRC representative. And it went like this. This horse is perfect. This horse has never had a bad day. I don't know what they're talking about. These rules are terrible. Steve, all 5 times we sent that horse in for diagnostics, and there was something there. So I can understand the frustration. I can understand when a trainer who's with that horse every single day, we're not calling them liars. We're not saying that they're trying to jam these horses in. We're saying, like I said before, 16 eyes are better than 2. And when you're on the front lines like that, a trainer is every single day, sometimes you're not seeing everything. And it's like an umpire in baseball. They can only see what they can see, and they're going to make mistakes because they're human. So again, 16 eyes are better than 2.
Well, the best news is as you referred, it seems like there's at least some, there's been some stability. Certainly the breeding side, when it comes to the cowbred program, you've had an influx of some nice new sires, to replace some big names and long-term, cow sires. So that helps. That helps the racing office, in terms of, you know,
40% of our programs. Field size is made up of cowbreds. So
how about
we're
that?
Very supportive.
I didn't know that number.
Program.
Wow.
We always have been, and we want to continue to be.
Wow. This is encouraging, and boy, everything's going right. If with the Fenton name on it, it's right. Everything, the horseplay, Little Red Feather, TOC, it's all good.
I'm very fortunate, Steve. I get to make my living in a business that I grew up loving. Went to the first Breeders' Cup in 1984, so I'm very grateful.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. You and Billy, and I, as I said to you before we started, it's really refreshing to have a Little Red Feather conversation and no Billy.
Billy does make things a lot breath of fresh air, and he's always sees things with the brightest of views and shakes things up. So I'm grateful to him too. We've been in business for 21 years. I've known the guy, I think, 45 years, and he's family.
He's irrepressible. He's with Molly Brown long dead. He's unsinkable. We got to come up with a. Is there a moniker for? Does Billy have like a nickname?
No, but we should come up with one.
Let's work on that.
Yeah, maybe your listeners can send us some emails. Give us some ideas.
You've had naming contests for the horses. We're going to have a naming contest for a nickname for Billy.
I love it. We'll tweet it out.
That is tremendous. Speaking of nicknames, later today at Mahoning Valley, and speaking of characters in the California owning world, the Jammer. And speaking of nicknames, the Jammer has got the horse starting today, the Justify Filly, that in fact Aaron Soans bred. How about that? And of course Soans had the big seller yesterday, the Uncle Mo.
That's very funny.
Jammer picked up on my Derby wife, and so she makes her start. Today. Derby wife being Ed Fontaine taught that to me years ago. Turf riders. It's the woman you pal around with in Louisville.
Derby wife. I love it.
There it is. and Jammer loved it, and he named this filly, so she starts today. Gary, thanks so much. This was fabulous, and I appreciate it. An overdue extended visit, but that's because you're doing all these wonderful things.
Steve, anytime, and continue good work, get home soon.
Good to have you. Gary Fenton, everybody. And, of course, you can follow. You can follow.
www.littleredfeather.com is where you can find us.
You got that. And then
LRF Racing, come tweet to us, or we're at Santa Anita every single day. Come find us, we love it out there.
And what about you?
I'm not on Twitter.
You're not on Twitter. I was going to say, I didn't...
Not a Twitter guy.
Well, and God bless you. there's a lot of us who wish we weren't either, right? It's, but it's, you know... When it's good, it's very good. Right.
It has its place. We certainly use it for marketing for Little Red Feather.
Yeah.
It's a great place for people to go and see what we're doing. But as you said, it's got its moments.
Gary Fenton, everybody. NHC, third place finisher. Chairman of the TOC and, of course, co-partner at Little Red Feather Racing. We didn't even talk about any runners, but good luck with those as well. I've seen you just had a
Gold Phoenix won the Grade One Kilroy.
Yes,
Super Horse.
We didn't even get to that.
Was in the Breeders' Cup last year.
I was there. I was standing
there. And the barn is really really humming right now, thanks to our great horsemen, our trainers, Phil D'Amato, Jeff Mullins. So very fortunate.
Outstanding. I forgot about that.
Looking forward to a good year.
Outstanding. Gary Fenton, everybody. Gary, thank you.
Awesome. Thank you.
Let's get Kip Elser in, and a pleasure. In fact, you know what? I could even let me take a picture of you guys together. That'll save space on the listing. You never met Kip Elser. That's not right. Exactly, the one and only Kirkwood Bloodstock advisor and more. Settle in, Kip. And what did Secura say? Is he's coming tomorrow? All right. Well, I guess he's expecting another seven-figure seller. All right. So we'll get John Secura tomorrow on the heels. There was not only actually, it'd be good because Sid'll be here. That's actually terrific. There was, in addition to the good magic at 7:25, Midnight Loot Philly. Talk about a pinhook success. 55,000 at Keeneland last year. $370,000 seller. Julie Davies, her name pops up left and right, and she consigned. Columbiana Bred, Sean Flanagan, purchased. So that was one of the nice pinhook hits of the day. Kip Elser. Good morning.
Morning, Steve. I had a great time listening to Gary. That's entertaining and informative all the way.
I mean, we didn't even get we talked about what they're doing at the sale, but I completely forgot to talk about the horses on the racetrack. And in fact, I've got a nice picture from Gold Phoenix winning the Kilrow a couple of weeks ago when we were out there. That was a fun day, a big cap day, and also the San Felipe, etc. Kip started the 2-year-old in training sale season. And it's not a new hat per se. It's a refashioned hat because you're not selling. You're taking on a new role, and you're certainly perfectly suited for it. Talk about the shift from Kirkwood Stables to Kirkwood Bloodstock Advisory.
Oh, it's just a natural progression. We've had a training barn and sold 2-year-olds for a long, long time. And this year, Helen and I decided to do it a little differently. It's time to switch leads or switch sticks or whatever you want to call.
Sure.
and head down the lane and work on the advising and buying side.
Interesting. And to some degree, it's just... It's not really all that different. You're just not going to. You're still going to be advising people, and enjoying relationships with people that you know that you developed horses for, or you know that you were pinhooking, or other pinhookers were had put in your hands. But in this case, what breadth of advisory are you including for this?
We have done and can do nearly anything. Right now, we're in the 2-year-old buying season and 2-year-old sale season. I've spent quite a bit of time here this winter watching horses train before they come to the sales grounds and on the sales grounds before they breeze. I think that's helped us some. And sit there and watch them breeze and help people pick out their next horse. quite a few of the people are people that have either had horses with us before or bought horses from us, and just doing things a little differently with advising people on the buying side, not necessarily with horses that we're selling.
This could include like weanlings, yearlings, everything.
Absolutely.
Start to finish.
Yeah, we happen to be in the prime season for
sure
for 2-year-olds, but come summer, I fully expect to be buying yearlings for people, and we've shown over the years that we can buy a good yearling and do it at a good price. And we've bought quite a few race horses, older horses, in the last 6 months, and just expanding the business. And it's expanding, but starting a new way of doing things. It's exciting.
Well, and you know, for those, anybody, obviously, a certain percentage, a large percentage of listeners have heard Kip for years, you know, talking about just about the industry, about the sires, about the, you know, the development of horses, etc. For those that may not know the extent of your record of success and the litany of horses that you've been associated with, and you're not a self-promoter, that's for sure, so you'll be shy about talking about these horses, but you talk about the ones you're most proud of over the years, Kip.
Oh boy. Most recent history, I think, where Mucho Gusto was very special. He developed into such a good horse, and he took a little more time. He was right here. We didn't get a bid for him, and
wow,
he blossomed.
Wow.
over the spring, and at Timonium, we got 6 1/4, and Bob and Michael Peterson and Donato saw what he had turned into, and then he came on and he won the Pegasus the next year. So that was, you know, a lot of fun to bring him along and watch him develop. We've had a lot of grass fillies over the years. We've had 3 Kentucky Oaks winners, the most recent Plum Pretty for
that's right,
for our neighbor and friend John Fort, and you know, it's been. Anyway, go back to the times when the pictures are in black and white.
well, talk about winter memories and that the whole family.
All those good Darby Dan fillies were great fun, and you know, having Alphabet Soup lay ahead on Cigar in the Breeders' Cup Classic in Toronto that day. That was a real highlight, and we've done quite a bit in England. We went over there to sell for a while. We've done things recently in New Zealand. It's been fun. This game will take you anywhere in the world you let it.
Well, because there's so many others that you haven't even touched on. When we say winter memories and Wonder Again?
Wonder Again, Soaring Softly, you know.
All of those.
The good Darby Dan fillies.
Now, all of them, yeah. You tried to put them into a, you gave it an umbrella, but the specifics, Cole Front?
Yeah.
Cole Front, right?
He was a good one here. He's at Spendthrift now. He won the Golden Shaheen a few years ago in Dubai. Only got a couple of 2-year-olds in this sale, I think.
Yeah, I think it ended up...
breezed well.
If I'm not mistaken, in fact, it came up yesterday, and Ned Toffee was here, and I'm just looking up, I'm curious. There was one, I think. Yeah, it sells today, $458.
Yep, yeah.
$458. A colt out of a More Than Ready mare. I would include, because Al Stahl is staying three doors down from me at the hotel. Tom's ready.
Absolutely. He was fun. We bought him for Dallas and the crew in New Orleans as a yearling at Saratoga, and he won the Woody Stevens on Belmont Day that year, and after running in the Derby, and then, as they say, a bridge too far, but he was a really, really good horse, going 7/8 in a flat mile.
What, and of course, part of the Benson phalanx, actually. I mean, that was a crazy year.
Well, that was an
for
amazing
Dallas
year.
And Tom, Dallas and Al and Tom Amos. The three of them all had stake horses. It was crazy.
First year the Bensons came in the business, and three different local guys training in New Orleans. Each of them got a good horse for them. It was magic.
It was a crazy, and then poor, and then to lose him like that. I was in New Orleans when he died.
What a wonderful man, and she's an absolute princess.
Joined by Kip Elser, and Kip has shifted the focus. Now Kirkwood Equine Advisory, and in terms of the market right now, Kip, what you know, given how dear horses are selling, I mean, how expensive basically, and the demand, not to mention, you know, it seems like a 2% decline in foal crop annually. So, I mean, there's less horses, and it seems like the demand is, I mean, nonstop, voracious, especially for you know, the top tier. But it does also feel these last couple of years that pressure has pushed downward, and the middle market that we were so worried about, you know, for middle part of the teens, it feels like that has thickened up and firmed up. So how do you suggest
I think it's a matter of working hard, due diligence, like you would in any other business. Work hard, do your homework. There are horses out there under the top, and it's proven every year. It's just a matter of getting out and walking the barn, standing at the racetrack, watch them train. You know, do your due diligence and work hard. They're out there.
Obviously, you've had relationships with all different levels of stakeholder. I asked this question yesterday. In fact, we had a terrific conversation with Tom McGreevy about this. You know, the most common mistakes that are made, and trying to avoid them. What's your feeling, and what do you tell people when you're introducing them to involvement in the game in terms of, you know, building a stable?
I think the most common mistakes are, there's so many technologies out there. You have to know how to weight them, how to prioritize all your information. Nobody has the answer. I think the make use of the technology, but don't let the science completely obliterate the art. And use the information judiciously.
The first thing that comes to mind, and I'm not looking to impugn any particular methodology when it comes to technologies, but you know, there was the advent, and I guess maybe in the last 15 years, the heart measurement stuff, and is that the kind of technology data that you have in mind, you're kind of hinting at?
It's absolutely a useful tool. Stride analysis is useful. The biomechanics programs are very, very useful, but they have to be balanced. And then it comes down, you know, all the pedigree and nicking analysis is very useful. There's more and more information out there, but the key is, as you keep climbing the steps toward the top rung on the ladder of who you're actually going to make an effort to buy, balancing all those different factors.
It would seem that the portion of it, the human portion of it, that is, you know, intrinsic, is the ability to look at a horse at whatever age, that weanling, that yearling, that two-year-old, even a three-year-old, and be able to, you know, see it standing there and envision it by looking at it and then projecting in your mind what that horse is going to look like. If it's a weanling, what is it going to look like as a yearling? What might it look like as a two-year-old? A yearling, what is it going to look like next year? Where is the growth going to come from? You know, based on the angles and all the measurements and, you know, all the things that, you know, are the classic points of a horse.
Well, you're not entering them today to run on the weekend. You have to...
That's great.
You've got to look at what are they going to be when it's time to enter them, and how are we going to get there, and who are the ones that are... who are most likely to stand up to the rigors of training and come out the other end. So that's part of my job.
Exactly. And that is not an area that can be, that, you know, is reduced to data, to stats. It's an experience. That's why, you know, when you say, and like McGrock, as McGreevy said yesterday, you know, said, how do you choose people to trust? And it comes from, you know, from track record and experience, the kind that you have. I'll ask you that same question. What flaws, what physical flaws are forgivable for you, and what aren't? What is something that will make you say this is a risk? I mean, and of course, risk is okay, and you know, there's varying degrees of risk. There's risk for 50,000, and there's risk for 500,000. You know, it depends on everybody's budget. But what's forgivable and what isn't when you look at a young horse?
That reminds me, a good story. I used to have horses for Brian Burns from Chicago.
Oh, Mount Joy.
Wonderful guy.
One of the most amazing people in the game.
And Brian always said, I understand risk. I insure quarterbacks. All I want's a fair shake. wonderful guy.
It's got an amazing story.
It's a great story.
Yeah, it was told on the air with Salty Roberts, and yeah. It's one of those things that until you hear it from somebody, you don't believe it. You don't believe a miracle is miracles are real until you listen to Brian Burns.
Yeah. It's anyway, that would be several hours more than we have on today's show, probably, you know, you work from the ground up, and so the faults in a foot are probably more serious than faults in an ankle or you know, you work your
way up. That's interesting. That I've never heard it put that way. That's from the ground. So the higher up the flaw, the less problematic it is.
And you can find a rule breaker horse every time you turn around. So again, you have to temper your judgment. But basically, you start from the ground up.
That's interesting. That is really interesting. And what will turn you away?
Well, you need to have, if they're hitting the ground, they need to have a balanced place to hit. So you start with that, and you work your way up, and it's geometry, physics, you know, concussion and propulsion.
Now we talked. It's funny. I'm glad you sort of, that sort of reinforces something I said yesterday, where we talked about corrective, particularly, and I wish I could do more with this, and I should, with farriers about what flaws a farrier can correct with the way in which they trim hooves and the way the horses are shot, because as I said with McGreevy yesterday, I mean it's the way they hit, and if they're not hitting evenly, they'll show an issue in the opposite limb, and then you get into chasing. When it comes to a sore horse.
Well, you chase problems from corner to corner.
There you go. Yeah. Well, this is exciting to me to have you doing this. How do you want people to get in touch?
KirkwoodEquineAdvisory.com, or the cell phone is 859-312-3414. It's on the website, and I'm easy to find.
You can, and in fact, you can still, if you, those of you that knew KirkwoodStables.com as the original, that still will get you to the website too, and I'm sure that'll continue forever. But Kirkwood Equine Advisory, Kip Elser's Equine Advisory. I'd love it. Portfolio Man, I'm just looking, actually, I just pulled the website up. Acquisitions and Sales, Portfolio Management, which would include, broodmare decisions and culling and adding and so right through till November in terms of sales. What kind of partnerships are you doing? Would you do some pinhook partnerships and things?
Yeah, we intend to, but I won't be getting them ready or selling them.
No, strictly the way. Well, in fact, we had Gary Fenton, the way put those. Yeah, I'm just pulling this up: racing, pinhooking, broodmare. Portfolio management, mating recommendations, appraisals, racing sales, stable management, and then the acquisition side, seasons and shares. It's funny, that came up with Sid a few weeks ago. And that's very cool that you put that, you include that on the underpinning. Auction and private, international sales, that's another thing. You don't even think of saying that about basically... being in touch with, having your fingers, on the pulse of, and picking out, horses that are, I'm not even going to say undervalued, but horses that might be for sale, ready-made runners.
Well, we were the first 2-year-old consigner, probably the only 2-year-old consigner to go to England to sell at the Craven sale years ago, and did that for 8 or 10 years. We've been in New Zealand. We built a great business pre-COVID in South Africa, and we just started buying in January back down there again. Bought a couple of yearlings at their sale down there. We intend to get back to New Zealand next year. Like I said, it'll take you anywhere in the world you'd let it.
Now, Kip, really excited for you to make this transition, and let's be honest, a little less physical, and a little, you don't think be out there every morning at 4:30. You've been getting up at 4:30 probably since you were about 14 or 12.
That's probably true,
right?
And now I still get up and have a cup of coffee and read the TDN for a little extra time before I go out.
Exactly right. Well, you could not be. I mean, obviously, we talked to some of the best
in the game on a regular basis, but you've been hearing Kip Elser with me for 15 years plus, and you could not be in better hands than whether you're getting started or whether you want to augment your operation. And you know Kip will be at Saratoga in the summer. He's in Keeneland and everywhere you look, every paddock I look, there's Kip Elser. And
First and foremost, I'm a racing fan.
Exactly. Well, you love no one would question that. And of course, Kip, when it comes to the jump set, the jump game, tremendous jump rider in the golden era.
Well, the golden era. Back when the pictures are black and white,
right? Fishbeck and Skiffington and you. Who else those days? Who else were they?
Actually, Tommy Skiffington is in Palm Beach with Show Horses now.
Yeah.
And doing a great
Absolutely.
Job
talk
down
to him.
There.
And, talk to him.
And his daughter is a top rider herself. It's great to watch.
Yeah, you rode against. Did you ride against Tommy?
And
Fishbeck was the tail end of his, we love. Well, and the season got started. In fact, I saw that Sean. We talked to Clancy last week, and Clancy won something point to point or something over the weekend.
The season kicks off in Aiken this weekend.
Exactly, and you'll be home.
I've got another hobby that I might have to. I've started driving Hackney ponies. So.
Oh my God! Unbelievable.
So I might skip.
Unbelievable.
I might skip next weekend and go to
Too
Kentucky
funny.
And drive.
I love that. That's tell us about that next. Kip Elser, everybody, Kirkwood Equine Advisory now, and if you're any of these areas, if you're looking for somebody to guide you into the game, Kip, not only will take care of you, you'll have fun. And that's why we're doing it.
Absolutely.
Kip, thank you. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Steve. Great to be here.
Always fun to connect with Kip Elser. I'm going to grab Ron Ellis, who's right there, and I saw him yesterday, and I wanted to catch up with him. We're going to only take the one break this morning like we did. Buck is in the foreground. I'm going to get Valerie in, too, because her long shadows, she's does a tremendous job on rescue. Always fun to see Kip, and I saw Ron Ellis yesterday, and I tried to flag him. You were heading into the back ring and to the barns, but I guess it's a California morning because I had Gary Fenton earlier, and here's Ron Ellis. Good morning.
Hi, Steve. Good to be here.
It's good to see you.
Yeah, thanks.
What's your impression of what's going on?
I think it's pretty typical of most sales. Is I think it's actually pretty fair. There's more horses this year than there was last year by maybe a couple hundred, and I think that's always helps the buyer a little bit because it spreads the money out amongst the horses a little different. But a lot of people land on the same horses, especially it seems like us California guys always like the same thing, so that drives the prices up. But I was happy I got one early yesterday. Hip number 16, that's where I was off to when I saw you, and I couldn't stop. So I was really happy to get a horse by Hardspun with a good family.
Well, it's funny that you nailed that horse because Jimmy? But no, it
16.
No, 325, but I think it was Jimmy Ventura who yesterday with me said, "Look for an early firework."
Uh huh.
It was the Hardspun that he had a feel for.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. Well, I know the horse was raised right. It was a Spendthrift Farm raised the horse, so I got a lot of confidence in them, and they were breeder. It wasn't a pinhook, so it was just a real comfortable situation. He worked 9-4, which he. Big horse, didn't look like he should be going, be able to go down there that fast, but looks like he's kind of a two-turn type horse, and if he can go 9-4 and keep going, we're going to be all right.
In fact, I'm just looking at the page. This is the family. The first dam doesn't have black type yet, But the second dam got Paradise Woods, that nice
exactly.
Sheriff's.
Yeah, John Sheriff's had her out there, and yeah, really, really a nice filly. And then that second dam also threw Forrest Chatter, who was a really nice horse out there.
That's right. Look at that.
For I think Dick Mandela had that one.
I think that. I think you're right.
They were both. They were both solid horses that stayed sound. I like to see some soundness in the families, because that's obviously a key component on a horse becoming good. But yeah, I thought the family was good. You know, you have to give somewhere. And I don't like to buy a horse that maybe a first-year sire and a mare that's unproven or proven bad. I don't like to go both sides of that. But, you know, I think Hardspun has been an underrated sire. And he, just because the mare hasn't thrown anything, she's young. She's only had a couple foals. So roll the dice there.
That's interesting that you frame it that way, and that's another lesson, you know, that where you know you've got a checklist,
mm-hmm.
and like for instance that first dam has not had a winner yet, as
right.
it happens.
Right.
So you are looking a little further down the page,
mm-hmm.
and then you know you may forgive you know the dam the first dam being empty. Based on the physical and based on the breeze and mm-hmm. and all the other factors that go into it.
Right, right. And I'd rather have a young mare that, you know, has only had a couple foals and maybe not proven than one that's had 14 foals and, you know, one stake winner and the rest of them can't run, you know. So
That's a great point.
Yeah, so I'd rather have one that's not proven that is proven to be mediocre or bad. So we kind of went with that, and like I said, he's a really nice individual. They had bought him back. Spencerf had bought him back as a yearling for 190, so they, you know, they liked him pretty much, and he was here to sell, and luckily, I think it helped going early in the sale, right, because the people that are looking for a nice
yep.
nice colt, they were kind of looking at that Justify yesterday and the Uncle Mo, and so, you know, they don't reach for one early in the sale. They're like, well, we like the other ones better, so maybe we'll wait for those. And then I think if this horse had sold late yesterday, he would have brought more money.
Ron Ellis joining us and looking at the purchase yesterday. Tell me about the client.
He's one of my longtime clients, and he's a great guy, and you know, I'm really excited to get it for him. We came here to buy, you know, two or three. Hopefully we can get that done, and it's, you know, it's a crapshoot though, right?
Always. In terms of your personal, you look at all the nice horses that you've trained, and of course you've had plenty of homebreds.
Yeah.
You think about the JMS products, although that's a mix, right? I mean, over the years.
Yeah, I've had kind of both. You know, I trained for the Y Gods for 12 years,
yep.
and they pretty much bred everything. And so most of all the good ones I had for them were homebreds. And, you know, or they might buy them as a yearling, something like that. And then JMS would, they'd had some homebreds. They'd mix them in, you know, buy a lot of yearlings and homebreds. And I've been very fortunate with the clients over the years that I've had, because I got a lot of support, and that's what you need to be successful.
Well, and when it comes to picking out horses, the ones that get off the van from the homebreds, they are what they are. What has been what's your preferred place along the way? I mean, the 2-year-old sales, the philosophy about, you know, about the breeze shows and you know, horses breezing fast, quote unquote, you know, versus yearling, the yearling market, mm-hmm. and you know, where do you feel is a sweet spot for you?
Well, you know, there's pros and cons to every age group that you buy them. I never bought weanlings, really. Those are just, I don't have an eye for them. It's too early for me. That would take somebody from the farms to really know what's going on. But I like buying yearlings. Yearlings are nice. You can get a little bit more pedigree than you can in the 2-year-old sales. But, you know, on the downside, you don't know much about them. You get to watch them walk, and that's it. I mean, I've always equated that to lead out a bunch of 10-year-old kids and try to decide which one's going to play Major League Baseball or the NFL, or, you know, you just can't do it, really. So, you know, you go with their walk and try to determine some athleticism, but certainly in 2-year-old in training sales, you get to see more what their talent level is. The one thing is that it's they're awfully hard on these horses so young. And so, you know, you've got to really, really pick and choose your spots. Look for a horse that, you know, is really taking the training. I'm a firm believer that, as in all athletics, there's some horses that are built to stay sound and will stay sound no matter what. And then there's a lot of them that just, you know, can't handle the rigors of the training. So, you know, the two-year-old sale gives you a chance to see which ones maybe are handling the training, which ones are a little bit sounder, and also you can see their talent level a little bit. You get to see their stride. So I've kind of morphed into really like to going to the two-year-old sales, and but certainly there's some obstacles because it is hard on them, and I like to give them at least a month off after the sale. Prefer 2 months, but if you want to get them running at, try to get them running at two. Usually a month is good, and if you checked them out well and they're pretty sound, you know, they recover after a month and are ready to go on.
My follow-up was going to be, what's your philosophy about letting the air out of the balloon a little bit? And, you know, because some depends on their mind, obviously. I mean, some are oblivious to it and they're happy to go on. But I can remember, as I started to get more acclimated to the two-year-old market, I remember asking back-to-back, it might have been the same show, Kieran McLaughlin and Peter Miller. Mm. And I said to them, what's your approach, you know, when they get to the barn? And Kieran said, I'd like to give them 4 to 6 weeks, mm-hmm. you know, just sort of, you know, just very easy. I mean, just, you know, light, you know, some walking and some light tack work and, sure. and just sort of let them, you know, kind of relax after being kind of drilled.
Yeah.
And Peter said that, you know, depending on who the consigner was, that he was quite comfortable, you know, going on with them.
Yeah.
He said they've already been exposed to a set of rigors.
Right.
And, you know, unless your approach is going to be completely new and different, you know, because, of course, you know, some of them, I suppose some are coming to racetracks for the first time. Others, you know, are going to end up at training centers or at a quiet, you know, a place, I don't know, if St. Louis Ray versus
right.
going to Santa Anita,
right.
you know, that kind of how different that actually is. But it's just very interesting. And, of course, it all also comes down to the individual and
right.
reading how they're acting.
Right. Well, and what you bought them for, too, makes a difference. You know, if you're buying a horse that looks like a real fast sprinter type that's probably going to, you know, be best at two or an early three, you're obviously going to go on with them.
Good point.
You know, because you want to go. If you're buying a two-turn, mile-and-a-quarter type horse for the Derby, you've got to get them to run at two, obviously, because the stats show that they've got to run at two to be able to win the Derby. But, you know, you don't have to get them running in July and August. They can get a start September, October, November, something like that. So, you know, it just depends on what you bought them for. I would imagine, like, Kieran McLaughlin was more getting horses that were kind of two-turn types, and there wasn't quite the hurry to go 5/8 of a mile, whereas Peter has a tendency to want to get some horses that are going to, you know, kick it right out of the gate and get going. So he does need to kind of go get going. So, you know, both philosophies have a lot of merit to them. It's just a matter of what type of horse you get and what your program is.
Well, and owner, you know, ownership, what their philosophy might be and what their needs are. And, you know, and also, let's be honest, you got a new owner that's anxious and wants results. I mean, yeah, that's a challenge.
Yeah, I think most owners now, they want to get them running as soon as possible. You know, they want to get them out there, get them going, and see what they can do, you know, see what they have. And I can't blame them. And they get excited. And, you know, the game sometimes does take a lot of patience. But I think they all want to try and get them running as early as possible.
Well, and they one of the messages that we hear regularly it's a challenge, especially with the more experience that people start to get. It's a challenge to just let the trainer you hired, and if there's any, you know, if there's other, you know, we just had Kip Elser talking about, you know, the advisory role that he's, you know, kind of refashioning himself into.
Mm-hmm.
You got to trust who you brought on. It, right? I mean, that's...
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, I've had a lot of success with young horses starting out late in their three-year-old year, and they've been horses that then go on to win grade ones and last a long time. You know, if you look in the...
Rail Trip.
You know, yeah, Rail Trip was one that started very late. Exotic Wood didn't start until Del Mar of her three-year-old year. You know, you look at Zenyatta didn't start until, I believe, November of her three-year-old year. So, you know, especially some if they've got some size to them, you know, or just needed a little bit more time. I mean, I've never been of the philosophy to push one that's got a problem early on just to get them to the races early, because it's certainly going to compromise their long-term effectiveness. So, you know, if they've got some issues that where they need some time and drags out a little bit, like I said, I've seen a pretty good track record of horses that start late, you know, mid to late three-year-old year, and then they go on to be really top horses and last a long time.
I'm going to bring up a funny horse that people might not immediately associate, but one of your grade one winners that was good at three and was good at four, and probably was involved in a lot of ways the most fascinating Santa Anita Derby ever. It was just Buzzard's Bay.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, Buzzard's Bay, actually, I didn't have him as an early three-year-old. Jeff Mullins had him as a three-year-old through the Derby. That was the year that I had Don't Get Mad. He ran fourth in the
fourth
Derby.
Fourth in the Derby.
Year. Yeah. And
wait, what was and he ran in that Santa Anita Derby.
Yeah, he did. He ran, and he ran that. Yeah, Don't Get Mad ran horrible in the Derby, and that's in the Santa Anita Derby ran terrible. I was so disappointed. The race previous to that, I had put him on Lasix for the first time. This is like one of those stories that is a one percenter where Don't Get Mad was some had an. Lasix had an effect on him that it just totally, because it's a diuretic and lowers blood pressure, he was a kind of a kickback, calm horse anyway, and it just put him to sleep. And the race before, he had won three out of four races without Lasix, and I was stretching him out in the race before the Santa Anita Derby, and I decided to go ahead and put him on Lasix and figuring, you know, that just kind of really help him out a little bit more. And he ran third to Giacomo in there, but it was on a sloppy racetrack, and so I was disappointed with the third place finish, but I kind of chalked it up to that. But I did notice he was kind of quiet in the saddling paddock. And so then we ran him back in the Santa Anita Derby once again on Lasix, and he ran just flat. He ran eighth, just kind of galloped around there. I go, God, that's not like him. He's got to be sick or something. But blood work all checked out, everything soundness-wise all checked out. So we got off the Derby trail, but I said, you know what, I'm going to run him in the Derby trial. And that's when they had the Derby trial the week before the Derby. And I took him off Lasix for that race. Gary Stevens rode him. He won by eight. And, I mean, looked like his old self, right? And I said, God, darn it, that Lasix just, that's the one horse that had, yeah, dulled too much, right? So I wheeled him back in 7 days and ran him in the Derby.
It's famous.
And, yep. He got caught 13, 14 wide like horses do, you know, and he ran a good fourth. But, yeah, that was kind of an interesting. He then won the Indiana Derby, ran fourth in the Travers. He, you know, everything with no Lasix. So that was kind of fun. I bought him out of a two-year-old sale. We paid $250 for him, and I believe probably this March sale. And he was the only one I'd bought that year. So he was a good one. But yeah, Buzzard's Bay, I got later in life. He had run in the Derby, and then he popped up in a sale in July. And he'd been off a little bit and had a couple bad races after the Derby. And we bought him. But, then he turned out great for us. He won the Oaklawn Handicap and, you know, won a couple other big races. So
that, I've said this for years, because of actually cashing tickets in that Derby, largely, not just because I ran into Mike Smith waiting for Wagner's to open. And he had just flown in at the beginning of Derby week, and I wrote a piece about Giacomo, but that wasn't it. For whatever reason, that Santa Anita Derby got maligned.
Uh-huh.
And it was a slow, early, fast, late race.
Right.
With Buzzard's Bay winning.
Yeah.
And the horse that the horse that Time Forgot that may have been as good as anybody in that race, Roger Stein's horse, General John B.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
General John
right.
B. who got hurt
right.
after the Santa Anita Derby.
Yeah, because they didn't do too much after that.
But Buzzards Bay, General John B., Wilco. Wilco was, I think, third in there.
Was he? Yeah,
Giacomo
that would have been
fourth.
That would have been his year, yeah.
Sweet Cat of Mine. People will, don't even remember.
Yeah.
Sweet Cat of Mine, she was the favorite.
Yeah, that's true. That's true, yeah. And she was having some trouble with bleeding going into that race. So, it did get maligned pretty well.
And it didn't deserve it. And then the horses that came out of that Santa Anita Derby ran like first, fourth, or they ended up peppering.
Uh-huh.
I think Wilco was seventh.
Yeah.
I mean, they ended up basically peppering the top third of the chart.
Right.
But because they all came home fast, and that's one of the, anyway. it's one of my favorite, you know, sort of weird forgotten races. That
funny
all
which ones.
Of,
funny which ones we remember, right?
It all has to do with cashing tickets. You know, 4 weeks later.
right.
Speaking of Kieran McLaughlin, of course, it's one of the most amazing. I mean, I was in that. I was in that pillbox above the tunnel.
Okay.
And came down because I saw that it was Giacomo that was winning.
Yeah.
And Kieran had watched it in that little TV room.
Right.
Lucas always watches.
Right. 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 Yeah. No, I don't know what you're talking about.
I just remember seeing Kieran. I mean, just wide eyed, like I thought we won it. I thought we were going to win it.
Yeah.
I thought we were going to win it.
Yeah.
And it was the drama associated with it with all of them. I mean, there's so many moments. You got the catalog open.
Yeah.
What have you been impressed with? I don't want to give away any targets, but
yeah.
What do you
today? I'm focused. I've got about four fillies that I like today. So I'm going to be got a colt yesterday. I'm going to be looking at some fillies today, and then tomorrow I've got a couple of each. So. Hopefully we'll be active a little bit, get another one or two, and be a successful sale.
Ron Ellis with us. A couple more minutes, Ron. I'll ask you the same thing. Gary Fenton, obviously, I mean, he's in a unique position with the little Red Feather and campaigning horses, and then as the chairman of the TOC,
mm-hmm.
He's on the front lines of what has been a lot of pressures, and...
Yep.
I mean, to be fair, we're about to enter this new unknown era.
Yeah.
I mean, if I can say it, point blank, I mean, you were caught in the most outlandish difficulty that involved, I think, a Buff Bradley, in terms of having to, deal with, the decision-making process that I brought up with him in terms of, veterinary advisory, when it comes to scratching horses. And, talk about what, how you are feeling about everything that's going on, having had to deal with just some really unfair elements of something that sort of is germane with this new HISA era.
Yeah, I think it's a very scary situation for trainers because it almost seems like they're looking to hang people. And, most drug positives, and I'm going to say 90 to 95% of them, are positive, are overages of drugs that, we might use every day. And they're therapeutics, and they just linger in the system a little bit longer than, what they say. I went through that with masochistic back, a shot that we gave over 2 months prior, lingered in the system to, down to picograms and nanograms and picograms and billions of, they just linger in the system. They get stuck in some fat cells or something, and they're just there, you don't know which ones those are going to be. So I think it's very scary, the penalties that they've got, going to impose for things. There's, accidental contamination that can easily happen. because there's a lot of drugs out there that aren't allowed to be in a horse's system that people recreationally use, you know. And I just think there's going to be some, you know, bad fallout. Some guys are going to get in trouble that, you know, really don't deserve to get in the type of trouble that they're going to get into, right? I think we all accept that, you know, once in a while we're going to get an overage of something, and you want to, you know, a reasonable penalty is fine. But, you know, we start giving 1 year, 2 year, 10 year bans, I think it gets a little problematic. But I think it's a very scary time moving forward for trainers with HISA coming in.
Like a jack in the box, like a genie, you just rub the lamp, right, and here's somebody on the HISA advisory committee. It's Ron Moquette.
How you doing?
How am I doing? I'm doing fine. I'm everywhere. I'm happy as a clam. What Ron's just expressing, you know,
two
exactly.
Don't make it right.
Hey, but I'm bummed. He'll be here all week, folks.
Yeah. So the interesting thing about me being on this advisor committee, right? This HISA advisory deal. I represent horsemen. And I'll say this, well, because I just actually had a conversation with a horseman, very, very, I want to say emotional and very heated and very invested. And I agree with everything he said, right? Me being on this committee doesn't mean that I agree with the Jockey Club, Stuart Janney, or any of the people that got this in. This means I am the guy that's supposed to voice your opinions. When you scream your opinions to me, it makes me think, first, you know, I want to strangle you for the way you're talking to me. And I don't hear you as well. So please, when you come up and you see somebody on the advisory committee, come up and say, hey, can you help me with this? Not, hey, what are you stupid blankety-blanks doing? We didn't do anything. We're here to say what you tell us to say. Make sure you say it in a way that we understand and we're not offended. We're actually here to help.
Well, and Ron experienced something that included the Breeders' Cup racing office. Yeah. That could have just said, you're probably better off not entering this horse but they said go ahead and enter, right. and then you get caught in this maelstrom of
yeah,
insanity.
And they had been testing the horse up to the race. They knew exactly what was in it, and I had reported that we had given the horse Winstrol, so there wasn't any underhandedness. Everybody knew what was going on, but hey, you know, that was a political thing, I think, and you know, it's past history. But you know, stuff like that's gonna happen.
Exactly.
I mean, they would have scratched that horse now. They wouldn't have let me enter, you know, in today's world. But they let me go ahead, and knowing what was going on. And
nobody.
So I kind of felt like I was set up a little bit. But
nobody wins with the gotcha mentality. It seemed like for a while they're playing gotcha mentality. Like,
right.
We want to show that we're doing our job by catching people.
Right.
Your job is to make it a clean sport.
Right.
It's not to try to wait and
right.
set somebody up to fail.
Right.
And
exactly.
Make it appear that it's anything less than what it is, which is probably the most tested and regulated sport that's going.
Yeah, definitely.
There's been several regulators. When you talk about the gotcha mentality, you had a regulator in New York. I mean, Rick Dutrow got his license back a couple of weeks ago after having a decade of his career ripped from him because of the eagerness of one regulator thinking that he was going to become Judge Roy Bean. You had the guy in Indiana who thought he was going to be the Judge Roy Bean and you know, basically, you know, absolutely finding the most picayune overages of therapeutics,
yeah,
and trying to humiliate horsemen every opportunity. I mean, what's the benefit? And then you've got you mentioned a group that has basically carpet bombed horsemen for over 10 years, utilizing those kinds of elements.
One of the problems that I have with HISA is, and I voice them at our meetings, is that we're okay with regulations, but we need common sense accompaniment.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, you have to understand that you have to have
horsemanship and common sense, or regulations don't do it. We don't need just unaccompanied regulation.
Right.
And we have more regulations than anybody I know. And now you've added the government's involvement. What they do is they regulate more. So
with more less understanding of what we do.
I've asked people before, have you ever put on a bandage?
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, I mean, and you'd be surprised. I mean, I know that sounds silly, but
no,
it's
silly
hard to be regulated by someone that doesn't understand the job that they're regulating. And there's some positives and there's some negatives of everything. And I would say that, you know, I think Lisa Lazarus is trying.
I think
Ben Moser of HIWU is trying. Now, however they got there, I don't care. But I know that if they do their job and they do an injection of common sense and they understand that their job is to make the sport better, not choke it out, then we all have a shot if HISA goes through. But if they come through there and they do the Mary Scalay, you know, talk down to you and everybody's in here, you should... The question that's floating around right now that I got called on this morning was that some of the people were like, well, you should do a better job testing your employees if you're ready or if you're worried that they may have a overage of or they may catch a contaminant of meth. And I'm like, well, if we're playing the liability game, then at what point does the commission be liable for allowing people? They're the ones with licenses. I just hired them.
You're right.
And all of a sudden I have to worry about the testing so bad that I'm worried that if a guy I hired yesterday is who he says he is and or she is and isn't going to do anything in the 3 days that it takes for me to find out that he's not dependable or whatever, that's going to affect my career forever.
Yep.
Well, to go along with that, even if a guy's not on drugs, you fire somebody, they want to get back at you, or they're mad at you for, you know, you just did whatever. I mean, it is so easy for them to contaminate one of your horses. So
I still believe that eventually horse racing wins when we test them before they go to the paddock.
Yeah.
I believe that, you say, okay, you call them the day before and say, hey, look, we tested you on Thursday. This is going to show up.
Yeah.
And you say, I believe that. And I also believe that you can't go anywhere in the world and not be surveilled. And the surveillance is a good thing. Surveillance will get you and me out of trouble.
Yeah.
And I have a lot of people that don't feel that way. But I believe that in a situation like you fire a disgruntled employee or who's not thinking clearly and wants to make sure you have a bad career, at least you could go back and look at the footage and say, you know, this is what happened. And I truly, in my heart, believe 99.9% of the people out there are there for the right reasons and doing good things.
Yeah.
But we shouldn't be subject to something for that 1%.
It's hard. And you know, we're in an era where, you know, look at what occurred with Mike Stidham. You got people questioning Mike Stidham's competence because one of his longtime
employees,
you know, gave a hard shove to one of his horses. I mean, you got people. Mike Stidham? You got to be kidding.
Yeah.
You're going to, you know, calling for, he should be fired, should be deported. Yeah. You're under this a microscope that makes it impossible to operate in even in good faith.
Yeah.
I mean, just as if everybody's supposed to be a robot now and there's going to be some sort of perfection achieved.
Well,
it's nonsense.
I love the way that Mike handled that. I love the way he handled that.
Yep.
He said the exact truth. This is not something that we condone. I'm sure this man that's worked for me for 100 years, I never saw him show this kind of activity before. We don't expect him to do it again. He made a horrible decision, and we're going to move forward with him knowing that this is not how we want to conduct business, and he is not representing us well doing that. I thought that was good. You know, but you couldn't get on social media. after that without him saying, calling for his career.
Right. Well, I mean, let's be honest. There's going to be some people that aren't going to be happy till horse racing's gone. So they're going to pick
fair
apart.
Point. Yeah. They're exactly
gonna,
right. Yeah. That's exactly right.
They're going to pick apart anything they can and blow it up a lot bigger than it should be, and that just because they are not going to be happy until horse racing is non-existent.
You're wrong. You're right.
If anybody has anything that I can represent them well, being on this advisor committee, you've got a problem, a gripe, or whatever, please come up and find me and let's talk about it, and let me be your voice. I agree with you 99% of the time, and I'll go in there and say it just like you want me to say it. So that's the message that I wanted.
There you go, Ron McQuaid.
We're very fortunate to have somebody of your stature on there.
Thank you.
Ron McQuaid, everybody. Ron Ellis, let you boys go buy some horses. We're about 20 minutes out. Ron, final thoughts, California, same thing I asked Fenton, there's been some rocky shoals.
Well, you know, we're really up against it out there because we're never going to get slot machines at the racetracks. And any of the racetracks that are thriving, you know, Oak Lawn, Churchill Downs, Keeneland, they've got the slots, and we don't, and we're not going to get them. So it's very tough to compete purse-wise with everybody around the country. And you know, it's tough because we still have the tough racing out there. We got Baffert, we got to run against, but when the purses are half as much, it's not as easy to get people to run out there. So we're up against it a little bit out there.
Well, been doing a great job for 25, 30 years, right?
Thanks.
So there's Ron here and out there as good a choice as you could make to send horses to. McQuaid. Moo Pig Sui.
Oh, how about them hogs?
How about them hogs?
I wanted to touch on that real quick about California. The amount of displaced horsemen that I see fleeing California right now, which are good horsemen that deserve to be. You know, Santa Anita and Del Mar has a huge colony of really classy, well-meant horsemen.
And to see them have to leave
to make a living is sad. And we root for them. I really don't want to run against you. I would rather run against someone not as good as you. But I'm just saying we are rooting for you.
Yeah, thanks.
Ronnie, thank you.
All right. Yeah, Steve, good to visit with you.
No social media for you, right? Do you have
I'm actually zero social media, and I'm happy about it.
All right.
Exactly. Got more time on my hands.
Ron Ellis, everybody. Let's take our only break of the morning. I think I see the TDN team over there. Valerie Buck's going to stop in as well as we hurtle toward the second half. Christina, too? Come on. Don't be ridiculous. Ronnie, let me get a picture of you two together. Come here first before you guys run off. Come a little closer.
Two wrongs don't make it right.
Hey, that's gonna be a you got to get a little closer to me here. Come here. There we go. No, stay where you are. Perfect. Perfect. Got it. Done. Beautiful.
That's going to be a prettier picture.
Well, that, always. Always. Case. You ready? Let's take the quick break right now, and because we have to, I've got to take one.
With Steve Beck on Sirius XM Radio. Here in Pennsylvania, we're proud of our breeding program, the best in North America. But we're also proud to be leaders in this industry. The PA Horse Breeders Association is funding cutting-edge research at Penn Vet into equine health and safety. And we endorse the SAFE Act to help protect the most vulnerable horses. Plus, we're pleased to support the aftercare programs set up by our horsemen's groups. Just a few of the reasons why you should join us in Pennsylvania, the premier place to breed and race.
Who are you betting on? How about an app created specifically for horse racing? Naira Bets. We specialize in thundering hooves, fist pumping, and boosting your bankroll with robust weekly promotions and offer betting tips from actual horse racing experts. Bet all day and night, nationwide. Get the action and thrill of horse racing with Naira Bets. $200 deposit match with promo Steve200. Visit NairaBets.com for details.
The Pons family's Country Life and Maryland Farms are the place for breeding and racing in the Mid-Atlantic. Country Life is nationally recognized for making stallions and curly stands, the Mid-Atlantic's leading first and second crop sires, Divining Rod by Tappan and Mosler by Warfront, as well as Frisian Fire. Maryland's 5/8 mile training track completes the full service facilities from the folding barn to the racetrack. Join the excitement of racing with Country Life Farm, where our partnerships can take you from beginning to winning.
Want to know a secret? The Massachusetts Breeding Program pays huge bonuses for finishing first, second, or third at any racetrack in the country. You didn't know that, did you? Massbreds get paid up to an additional 25% of their purse earnings for the owner, and breeder, and stallion owner, and developer. It's the best-kept secret in racing, till now. Tell all your friends, and to learn more, visit massbreds.com.
Would you believe that champions weren't measured by rings, but by a crown? That the